All right. Again, once again, our speaker today is Tracy C. It's all you, darling.
Hey, everybody. Tracy, person in recovery, alcoholic, addict, whatever. Everything. As she said, I go to a few different fellowships, and I hope that I'm loud enough. I got this microphone thing here because nobody could hear me when I was in meetings and in meetings at work. So it wasn't just that I thought I wanted to look like a DJ or something. My voice just doesn't carry for whatever reason. Even when I'm talking to somebody in person, they're like, what? I don't know what that is. But anyway, so is this, and Megan, I'm going to have you on the recording. I'm sorry. And we're supposed to just give a full lead, or is there, am I supposed to stop and give a topic, or what's the format?
You're supposed to tell us your story.
Just tell the story. Got it. Yep. Okay. So I have done a Tuscanoosa a long, long time ago, early pandemic. And I've changed a lot since then, which is really interesting. My story is a lot like everyone else's. I mean, I drank too much. I drank because of low self-esteem. I drank because of, it was Thursday. I drank because I was mad. I drank for whatever, reasons. And for some reason, I have that gene or whatever it is that when I drink or when I get high, I can't stop. I don't want to stop, that's basically it. I could tell you a bunch of stuff about my childhood. Nobody wants to hear that. I'm going to give you a brief of that. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm the youngest of three in an adopted family. And I was adopted, and I'm the youngest of three. I was a foster child. So I was in the foster child of the system, if they call it. Until I was 18, I aged out of it. I was never adopted. I was a foster child. So that means I was with a family and nobody ever came in to adopt me. But that was fine. The family I was with treated me like their son. I never felt any different, from them. I always felt different in my own head. That feeling was always there. I always felt like I was on the outside. I always felt like awkward. I always felt shy. I was very much an introvert, very much kept to myself. I have no problem being alone. Matter of fact, I love being alone, maybe to a fault. I think I can take being alone alcoholically. Like, I overdo everything. Anything I do, I want to overdo it, and I get carried away with it. My childhood was, I had friends and I had family and I had, normal stuff for the most part. I can't say that I had a lot of trauma or stuff like that, but the trauma that I'm now learning about in my older years is generational. It wasn't things that were done to me on purpose, like because somebody was drinking or somebody was narcissistic or somebody was abusive. My family wasn't any of that, but I did get regular whoopings, as we used to call them. But again, that's generational. It wasn't my parents disciplined me because that's the way they were disciplined, and that's the way they thought everybody was disciplined, which was, if you did something wrong, you got the belt or the comb or the wooden spoon or whatever, and that's just the way it was. And I didn't realize that it was bad. It was just the way it was for me, because everybody was getting a whooping and got a belt if you did something bad. You never got talked to as to why you did something wrong or here's the way to do it right. It was just like, you did something wrong, come over here and I'm going to beat you. And, that's the way it was. And learning now that a lot of this stuff is abuse, and a lot of it is traumatic and played into the trauma that carried a lot of my thinking And I even though I had that happen, the trauma and that, I feel like I still felt awkward and on the outside, even before all of that, you know, as from the youngest age, I could feel that. So yeah, I mean, that was there, but when alcohol came along, which was my dad was in the army. So my dad, he was a sergeant in the army. He fought in the war. They lived in Germany. He fought in the Korean War. And so he had access to the local PX, which is the army guys get special rates and, you know, they could go get alcohol and stuff. So my dad kept alcohol in the house. He had a bar in the basement and he drank and he had people over and they drank and they had parties. My mom and dad entertained. And, you know, that was normal around me. And first time I had alcohol was when I was a kid. You know, they gave me a little taste of it and I thought it was horrible, but I like how it made me feel. And that was it. That was it. And when you think back now, you know, that was the start of it. You know, that's because I knew I liked how it made me feel. Made me feel better. You know, I finally felt not awkward. I finally felt not shy. I finally felt whatever that was, you know. But I didn't do it again for a long, long time. Till I was old enough. And I started hanging around with some friends and their brothers would get us alcohol and drugs and stuff. And it was fun. You know, like getting high and drunk was fun. And I mean, I hear this a lot of times with a lot of people. Alcohol and drugs worked until it didn't. You know, I'm an artist. I'm a graphic artist. So I do drawings and art and stuff. And when I went to school, I went to the Art Institute of Pittsburgh for college. And it was an art school. It was like almost like a trade school thing. But I went to Pittsburgh and we had an art history class. And I heard about all these artists and how they were quirky and weird. And they drank and they got high. And the guy cut his ear off. And you know what I mean? And I thought, yeah, that's I must fit right in there. You know, I'm an artist, you know. And which was not true. These people, they had mental health issues. It's the reality of it. And I had to realize I have mental health issues. That's fucked up, you know? So anyway, I used all of those types of excuses to continue doing what I was doing, which was getting high and half-assed living my life, which is basically what I was doing. I would just half-assed live my life. I would, as far as school grades and all that stuff, I would get by. And that was the story of me. It was just get by. I never really was excelling at, I was never going to be on the valedictorian of the school or the class president or none of that shit. That took too much effort. Ugh. You know, I got to be around people and I got to talk to them and stuff. No, I just want to be alone. Just leave me alone. Let me get high. Let me drink and I'm fine. That's me, you know. Just a simple guy just wants to get fucked up and leave me alone. I would hang out with my friends, but even with that, I would only hang out with them for so long until I wanted to go and be alone, you know, and do what I wanted to do. So anyway, so hung around with those guys during high school. Did just enough work to get myself into art school in Pittsburgh. And luckily I could draw. I'm pretty good at it. And I don't say that to brag, but for me to be able to do it high and drunk and still get to college and get, you know, loans and grants and stuff, you know, I realized I must be pretty good at it, you know. But even that I never felt comfortable in. Being an artist is tough because you're putting yourself out there, you know, you're sharing ideas and thoughts and people critique them. And that's, you know, when you're full of shame and guilt like I am, and when you're an introvert, that's the toughest freaking thing in the world, to put yourself out there like that and have people critique you, you know. But you know what? I did what I had to do and I got through. But when I went to Pittsburgh, man, that was party time. I had so much fun partying in Pittsburgh, you know, and I was still young, so my body could still take it. You know, you could take a beating and get back up the next day and still go do what you had to do, you know. Remember those days? So yeah, that was Pittsburgh, you know, for the most part. Lots of partying, just getting by. Just got by through college. I got loans. I had like bank loans and stuff through college, and I remember getting some refunds because they would pay a certain amount to the college, the bank, and then I would get a refund check. And the idea was to save the refund check and then pay back the rest of the loan, you know, save it. But I didn't realize that at the time. So I would just take the refund check for a couple $1,000, cash it. And, you know, what are we going to do? Should I get some art supplies? Maybe I should get some clothing or some food. No, we're going out to get fucked up. That's what we're going to do. So me and my other buddies went out and, you know, we did what we did. In Pittsburgh, and half-assed. That's what I do. I half-assed live my life. That's what I did. So I finally got through art school and college and got out and moved back with my parents. And, you know, I thought that I was supposed to have this prestigious career in graphic design and advertising. And, yeah, that didn't really pan out the way I wanted to, because I just did everything half-assed, you know. And I had this idea that because I went to school, I went to college, I was supposed to start off at, you know, the top level, be the upper echelon of designers. And I was not, you know, I was hit with reality. And the reality is you start off at the bottom, you know, and you work your way up. I didn't realize that, you know, they probably told me that, but I didn't hear it. Because I didn't want to hear it. Because I was probably high or drunk when they did tell me. So we're hungover. So I went to this ad agency one time. They had a placement guy in the college, and he got me job interviews, you know. And I went to this ad agency in downtown Cleveland, up on the whatever umpteenth floor of this building, and showed this guy my portfolio from college, you know, and thought it was the bomb. And, He kind of gave me a dose of reality. He's like, yeah, you're not ready yet, you know, but, you know, come back in a few years. This is like, I remember this, the first interview that I had. He's come back in a few years and, you know, and you've got some experience. And I just remember being, have so much resentment at this guy. I went out and just, I tied one on. I just remember going out that day, threw my portfolio of all my art in the basement somewhere in my parents' house. And I'm like, I'm never going on these job interviews again. This is bullshit. And that was my mentality, that I should be given stuff. I should be given the best, you know, I should not have to work for it, you know? So anyway, that happened. And from that point on, my alcoholism and drug addiction just took off. You know, it really did escalate. It was always a progression. There was never a point where I was like stopping or thought that I had a problem or anything. I was still able to function. I'm still young. Like I said, my body could handle it. So I was still able to function, and I had a few dollars, you know, and from just half-assed jobs. Like I said, I had a job in a warehouse doing document shredding, and, you know, I mean, never like the thing that I went to college for. I was never living up to my full potential. Because full potential meant that I had to be responsible, and I had to do work, and I had to, you know, get up in the morning on time, and I had to shower, and I had to, you know, do those crazy things like that, you know, those weird people do, you know what I mean? Take the bus to work, and I'm supposed to have a car. What the hell? Take the bus. Do you know who I think I am? You know? And all of these things, I would just have these resentments, and I would drink over and get high over them. And it was just a cycle. That was just how I lived, half ass, you know. And so the crack epidemic came up in the world. And that was a glorious time. Oh, my God. When I had the first time I did that stuff, it was just it was just bottom. I was just bottomed out. That was what took me under, you know. Up until this time, I was able to hang out with buddies and friends and you know, get by, like I said. And But my mentality was still, I should have something. And I still had that shyness and that fear, which I now know today was a lot of it was codependency that I deal with. And I always looked for people outside of me to validate me. I always looked for my dad or my friends or my family to tell me that something was okay. And I always looked to the people around me, which were drinking buddies at that time, to tell me, yeah, man, you're doing great, you know? And I would think, okay, they think I'm doing great, so I must be doing great. I never thought for myself. I never thought, you know, how do I evaluate myself and to see if I'm living up to my own standards and principles and morals? You know, nobody ever showed me how to do that. I never thought of how to do that. And it was just a scary place to be. I was scared all the time. I was constantly looking for something or someone outside of me to make me feel whole, you know, to make me feel comfortable in my own skin. And alcohol, drugs, and people, you know, people, places, and things, you know, and that whole lifestyle and everything surrounding all of that was what did it for me. And I thought that was okay. And, you know, and then crack came in. And like I said, it just took me under. The people, the guys that I would hang around, the friends, we started to distance from each other. That's all of our alcoholism started to distance us from each other, you know. And being a loner, I never thought anything of it, you know. I thought, you know, oh, I'm better than those guys. And I'm going to go do my crack by myself because that's more for me. And that was just the gutter for me when I started to do that. And I was stealing. I was breaking into houses. My grandma would come and live with us. My grandmother lived in the South, and she didn't believe in banks. So she kept all of her money in like white tube socks. And so they would bring my grandmother, my mother and father would go down to Mississippi where my grandma lived. We're in Ohio, and bring her up every winter. And she would come up with this bag, and they would protect that bag like it was Fort Knox. And I would always wonder, because I would unload the car, and I would always wonder, they were like, oh, get that bag, we'll get that. And I'd always wonder, what's in that bag? So finally one day, me being me, I had to sneak in and open that bag. And what did I find? Jackpot. Now I know what's in that bag. And I'm on crack now. So that was just like dollar signs. And I just thought, you know, I hit the jack. I thought that I hit the lottery. And I thought I hit the crack lottery, though. So I don't know if that's good or not, but no. So I didn't just take the whole bag. You know, I got to be sneaky. So I would just take a little money out of one, each sock. Do you know what I mean? And eventually, as my drug as addiction progresses, as it does, I would take a little more money out of each sock, you know, and then it came, I would just take a whole sock, not all the socks, just one of the socks, you know, and these socks were just getting lighter and lighter. And it was horrible. I thought I was going to be a drug dealer one time. I took all this money and I bought a lot of, you know, of drugs. And so I'm showing my age here. This was before cell phones and stuff. People had pagers. So I called up a few friends and told them, I'm dealing now, man. You know, got them rocks. And so I had all of these drugs. And I'm like, okay, well, while I'm waiting for people to call, I'm just going to do a few myself, you know, just, you know, because I'm bored and I'm an addict. So. And that turned into a few more, and then a few more, and then a few more. Hey, Bugsy. And next thing you know, I had no drugs left. You know, that was in one night. I did all of this. I mean, it was thousands of dollars that I took from my grandmother. And I don't think I slept for a week after that. And it was just like that. You don't sleep, you don't bathe, you don't go to work, you don't. I didn't have a job by then, obviously. I'd lost my job because I wasn't going to work. Because if I did have a when I did have a job, I would get my paycheck, go directly to cash it, and then you wouldn't see me, you know, until maybe a week and a half later. And so yeah, drugs and alcohol definitely took me down, you know. And so my brother, my sister, and my father. But by the way, the job that I had when I would leave and cash my checks, they sent me to treatment about 8 times. And because that was the law, you had to give a person a chance to go to treatment. So they did that. And I went to treatment and I would just kind of, again, half-ass do that, just say enough to get out of trouble, you know. But there was a seed planted for sure, you know. And as when it came down to the last days, if you will, it was my father and sister took me to a outpatient IOP, and they did an intervention thing, and they tricked me into going there. Basically, they said, I don't even remember what they told me. It was so long ago. They told me we're going out to eat or something, I'm guessing. But so we went to this treatment place and we walked in. This lady's showing us around. Here's the beds. Here's the kitchen. And I'm like, what the hell is this? So they circle around the place. You know, they go in the front door and they go around the back. And they showing us the place, and my father and sister are walking out the front door, and I'm walking with them, and they're like, "Where are you going?" And I'm like, "We're going home, aren't we? We're going home. You're not going home." And I'm like, "Wow, is it that bad? Did they have to trick me into, you know, getting help?" And so I stayed there for, you know, like the 30 days or whatever, and still half-assed though. I thought maybe I should try this, and I didn't stick. I wasn't ready. And I look at all these things when I didn't do it, and now I know, like, wow, I just was not ready for that. You know, I can just see it in other people now. You know, like, it's not ready. They're not ready. Unfortunately, I hope they stay long enough to think they become ready till they, that whatever hits them. You know, because I'm glad I became ready, because I know I have all those friends that I drank with. They're all dead now, you know, from alcohol or alcohol related, you know, situations. That was the life. That's the life. If you stay in that life, the alcohol is going to kill you, or your health is going to kill you, or somebody else that you drink with is going to kill you. Something in that lifestyle is going to end your life, you know. And it's not going to be pretty. And I'm glad I got out of it. And I think there's only one guy that I used to drink with that's still alive out of the, you know, 12 or 15 that were around the neighborhood there. One of them committed suicide. Another one had a heart transplant, and he couldn't stop drinking with the heart transplant. You know, there's medications that you take when you get a transplant, and you're not supposed to drink alcohol. But he couldn't stop drinking. And of course, he died. You know, he was given the gift of a new heart, and he could not stop drinking to live. You know, that's just, alcoholism and addiction is just mind blowing. Untreated alcohol and addiction, excuse me, is mind blowing. And I'm very grateful that I was able to stop and able to take the gifts that were given to me when they were. So yeah, I finally started going to AA. I started going to AA through treatment, and it started to take hold, but I had a lot of relapses, a lot of little slips. It was never a big blown out, like go out for a month, come back for a day. It was more like I would be going and I would just go drink a couple days and come back. You know, something hit me that made me come back. You know, some of the stuff that they were saying in here about, you know, this disease and this allergy we're starting to set in. And then a lot of the stuff I learned in treatment, outpatient, you know, like I said, the seed was planted way, way back. You know, once you know that there's another way and that seed gets planted in you, it's hard. It makes it just shitty to go out and drink. You know, that's always there with you. Like, what? And then I call it the noise, and the noise is my family and my job and just the people talking to me all the time, like, you need to stop, or, you know, just the trouble that just follows you around when you're drinking actively, when you're an active alcoholic or addict. It's just this noise that's always there. Like, you can't relax. You can't just be, you know, I can't just sit on a beach and enjoy the water and smoke crack. You know what I mean? There's no, it doesn't fit. They don't fit together. I can't go to work and sit at my desk like I'm doing right now and do drawings with a drink here. You know what I mean? And because there's no, it doesn't fit. They don't go together, you know? And so I had to learn that, and I learned it the hard way, but I learned it. And I'm glad that I learned it. Even when I did learn it, when I stopped finally, was when I was in an AA meeting, my first sponsor, and there was a lead, like I'm giving a share here now. And I stood up after the share, because it was in-person meetings, and I said a comment or something. I don't know what I said. After the meeting, my sponsor told me to sit down and be quiet, because I was very early, very new. He was one of those fundamental guy. You know, you don't say nothing. He poked me in the chest. You don't say nothing. You sit down and be quiet and listen, because you don't know nothing yet. And I was like, you motherfucker, you know? And I was pissed. I'm a grown ass man. How are you going to tell me to be quiet? You know? And, but he was right. I didn't know anything. You know? I don't believe in the whole, you don't say anything. No, I think we've gotten past a lot of that. I haven't been to any just Orthodox AA meetings in quite a while, but in person especially. So I don't know. But I think especially on Zoom and the few meetings I do go to, especially agnostic meetings, we don't care how long you've been here. You're allowed to talk and say something if you need to and share. I never got that whole thing, but so yeah, I he did that, and I said, you know what, you'd think I would have went out and drank, but I said, you know what, I'm going to show you that this shit don't work, you know. And that was July of 1991, and that was the last time I drank, you know. It was the night before that, and I just stayed. And of course I started, that was an ego thing. I wasn't going to show him shit. You know what I mean? And then, so I listened, I did some of the stuff they said. I just did some of the stuff. Remember, half-assed measures availed us nothing, but they do, believe me. If you just half-ass try this thing, the only thing you got to do right 100% is not drink. Don't pick up the first drink or drug. You've got to do that perfectly. I did everything just kind of half-ass, and I stayed sober, and I got a little bit of, I got some out of it. I started to feel a little better. People started to talk to me normally again. The noise started to calm down, you know, and, And I kind of went along with that for a long time. And I prayed. I used to pray. I prayed a third step prayer. I did all the prayers and I knew all those. And I never sponsored anybody. When that started to come around for me sponsoring, I just, the anxiety and the awkwardness would just be heightened, you know? And I finally got a hold of that through going to some counselors. I finally found a good counselor. I went through a lot of those. If you go to a counselor and you're not feeling good when you leave there, then you probably should, I don't want to tell, but I'm not a doctor, so I shouldn't say, this is what I had to do. I went to a few counselors. I didn't feel good there, but I stayed because I thought I was supposed to, and I was afraid to say, I don't like this because of anxiety and codependency. Just go get another sponsor. That's what I did. Find a better sponsor, or not sponsor, a better counselor. Sponsors too. You're allowed to get another sponsor if you don't like your sponsor, but try the sponsor or counselor out for a period of time before you just run away. That's what I had to do. and I learned to do. I found a codependency group that I go to now, and I just love it to death. And what it's helped me do is enhance my sobriety. I don't stop going to AA meetings because I do have alcoholism as a result of the codependency. I didn't realize that the codependency was so strong. And I didn't realize a lot of the things that I was doing were codependent based. And then I was using the drugs and the alcohol to stop feeling the codependency, you know? And once you move to alcohol and drugs, then there's the codependency, you know, it's heightened. It took me a long time to realize that. And I'm talking about sex addiction. I'm talking about drug addiction. I'm talking about drinking. I'm talking about whatever, the shopping. I go to any of these 12-step groups. If I went gambling, I wanted a little bit. I didn't take that. Didn't take to me, but I could definitely see me getting crazy with gambling, with scratch off tickets. I know a friend who did that. You know, I'm an addict. So I'm always looking for something outside of my this to make me feel good about this, you know, because I don't feel good about it. And I think, you know, there has to be an answer outside of me. I can't just tell myself, Tracy, you did pretty good today. Tracy, I love you. You know, somebody told me to look in the mirror and tell myself that I love you. Tell you. And I'm like, are you fucking crazy? You know, but I learned to do that, learned to love myself, you know, but I had to let you love me until I could learn to love myself. That's what I had to do. There's probably a lot of more ancillary little bullshit that I could say, but I love this program and I love all the people in it. And everybody in AA is everybody. If the last thing I'll say is everybody in AA is in AA. So they're probably as sick as I am. So just keep that in mind, because I've had situations where I thought this is supposed to be the perfect place, and it is the perfect place for me to get to recover from, you know, addiction and the codependency. If I take the tools and apply them, the people are all imperfect. Just remember that. And I'm imperfect. I don't say that as a, to put it down or anything. I'm just saying, just keep that in mind. You know, everybody's here working, trying to figure it out. My sponsor's here trying to figure it out. His sponsor's here trying to figure it out. You know, so, you know, be easy on them. Be easy on yourself. Be gentle with yourself. And, you know, that's it. Thank you.